This is the BBC third program. We present A Hedge Backwards, a discovery for radio by Henry Reed, concerning the researches of the scholar Herbert Reeve into the lives of Richard Schoen, a very great man indeed, Hilda Tablet, and others. Mr. Reeve.
We had been ordered to rest a great deal. It had been well said that rest was what we needed. And indeed, the time seemed not unpropitious for rest. We had had, temporarily, to lay aside our work on the biography in two volumes of the late novelist Richard Schoen, in order, temporarily, to embark on the biography in 12 of the well-known composeress Hilda Tablet, still happily with us. We had all but begun the second of these tasks when a brief respite seemed to offer itself. Miss Tablet, in the company of her young singer, Miss Elsa Strauss, was departing for her annual holiday in North Africa. On the beautiful airport terrace, she had given us our final instructions.
And Bertie?
Yes, Hilda?
Don't overwork. Just do as much of it as you can every day, but don't overwork, see? You've got a clear run ahead of you, haven't you?
Run, Hilda?
Time, I mean. You've got plenty of time.
Well, actually, Hilda, there was just one thing...
Good. Elsa, what have you been buying all those packets of sandwiches for? We shall be having lunch the minute we're in the air.
These are for between lunch and tea.
Save me from madness. Were you saying something, Bertie?
Well, it was just that... I hope you don't mind, Hilda, but there is just one little point in my work on Richard Schoen that I thought I might perhaps try and clear up while you were away.
Really, Bertie? The minute my back's turned...
Well, it was just something that...
Look at me, Bertie.
Yes, Hilda?
I hope you're not planning to do anything dishonorable, are you?
No, Hilda, please don't think that.
Well, it's a very strange world, I must say. People upsetting people just as they're about to start off on a brief and, as I'd hoped, well-earned holiday. Bit shabby, I'd have thought. I may be wrong.
No, Hilda, I do assure you that...
All right. Come on, Elsa. Goodbye, Herbert.
Goodbye, Hilda.
Dishonorable? Shabby? No, we ardently trusted not. Nevertheless, on the way back from the airport, we could not wholly suppress a spasm of guilt when we recalled that we had failed to disclose the fact that we were about to call on Mr. Stephen Schoen, the late novelist's brother, that same afternoon. Alas for conscience, our guilt was quickly eclipsed by the prospect of resuming, if only so briefly, afternoons of placid and illuminating discourse, leisurely, human, and cheering.
I suffered greatly, Mr. Reeve.
Yes, I'm sure, Mr. Schoen, I'm very sorry.
I have often suffered greatly, Mr. Reeve.
Yes.
Yes.
Mr. Schoen, I wonder if your late
Mr.
brother...
Mr. Reeve, you are a man of very wide literary cognizance. Have you ever encountered the expression, it was like being pulled through a hedge backwards?
Oh, yes, indeed. Very, very racy.
Have you ever felt like that yourself?
Well, sometimes, perhaps.
I suppose Miss Hilda Tablet makes you feel like that.
Oh, no, I wouldn't say that.
She's made countless others feel the same. Mr. Reeve, on the occasions when, as you put it, you have felt as though you were being pulled through a hedge backwards, have you ever meditated for a moment on what it might feel like to be the hedge itself?
No, no.
It's no matter for mirth, Mr. Reeve. I will tell you something. I am a hedge, Mr. Reeve.
Oh,
yes, a hedge. Many people and many things have been pulled backwards through me. And if my foliage seems a little wantonly battered here and there, it is solely due to that fact. My life has been a very sad one, Mr. Reeve.
Oh, I'm sure.
Not, of course, that it has been sadly borne. No, I think I may claim to have always commanded some small smack of fortitude. All the same, Mr. Reeve, had my character ever become blighted, darkened, umbrageous, or despondent, who could have cast the first stone at me?
Yes, who indeed?
Why, my wife, of course, Mr. Reeve. She, my wife. Of all my graver misfortunes, the shameless architectress. Ah, here she is.
Now, down, good pussy. Down. Ooh, down, there's a darling. I'm sorry tea is so late, Mr. Reeve, but I had to get it myself. Here we are.
Oh, let me help you with the tray. You really ought not to have bothered.
Oh, it was no trouble. Down, pussy. It's just that we have somebody's little birthday in the house today. Haven't we, Snow Dove? And I had to send the girl to the shops before they close to get some nice H-A-L-I-B-U-T for B-U-S-S-I-E-S.
A hedge backwards.
There. We'll have tea by the fire. Do bring your chair a little closer, Mr. Reed.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. Sherwin.
A hedge.
What did you say, dear?
A hedge. Get down!
Stephen!
Had you ever played darts, Mr. Reeve?
Because
I am also a dartboard, Mr. Reeve. I am not only a hedge, I am one of nature's dartboards. Like St. Sebastian.
Now, let's have some nice tea, shall we? Then we shall all feel better. I do hope you like these cakes, Mr. Reeve. Our new girl made them. She's French. She's over here to learn English.
Oh, really? Is she getting on well at it?
Oh, well, of course, it is still better if we speak in French, but she is picking up a little. Yes, just a little. Now, how do you like your tea? I'll... Oh. No. How ridiculous.
What?
I've forgotten to put any tea in the pot. I'm just pouring out hot water. Funny.
I foresaw this.
Now, I wonder what it means.
Means? It means that in your unconscious mind you wished Mr. Reed hadn't come to tea.
Oh, I do hope...
Don't be silly, dear. It means either a telegram or a registered letter. It's one or the other, I'm sure. I shall look it up in my book. Do forgive me, Mr. Reeve. I'll go and make some fresh. And we'll put a lot of lovely real tea in the pot again, won't we? A bright pussy. Yes.
I'm sorry my wife makes you so unwelcome, Mr. Reeve.
Oh, I'm sure she didn't
but
mean
it. But it's all of a piece, isn't it? We are very lucky to have shamed her into making amends. I have sometimes had to make do with hot water instead of tea for months on end.
How pleasant it was to be back here. To feel ourselves once more sitting there so intimately with the brother of Richard Schoen. How easy, natural, and inevitable it was to recall the charming idylls of brotherhood which abound in the Schoen novels. It was so clear to us now where they had had their fount and origin.
There, by the familiar shining stream, Peter looked at Paul. It was as though he were seeing him for the first time. Or no, not seeing him for the first time, but for the first time realizing that Paul was his brother. The words formed in his thought like some utterance from Holy Writ. Thou art my brother. Peter had never known it so innerly until he had seen Paul there by the stream, in tears, his thin young nakedness shivering in the intense heat. Thou art my brother. And suddenly he had said it aloud.
That my brother.
And Paul looked at him. They looked at each other. Paul sniffed and stared hard downstream, unseeing, and said in his still unbroken voice,
They can bloody chalk their sense for all I bloody care. Bloody wenches, I dunna give nothing for none on 'em.
That my brother, Paul Stilt. And so long as there's my brother and I'm thine, well, then who's what? Doesn't.
Aye, reckon I do.
So be it, lad. Get the breeches on, lad. Hasn't forgot, has Paul?
Forgot what?
Why, Paul, lad, we'm got jam for tea.
End of book the first.
What are you thinking about, Mr. Reeve?
Oh, a passage from one of your brother's books, Mr. Sherwin.
Oh, how kind of you, Mr. Reeve.
Brother, indeed. I may see, Mr. Reed, that my brother frequently cast the most painful doubts upon our relationship. You are a bastard, Steve, he used to say. You are a bastard, Steve, and you know it. I quote his words verbatim, Mr. Reed.
Oh, dear.
Oh, but, Mr. Schoen, that expression is quite often used as, well, almost as a term of endearment.
Oh, you must move among persons of a very peculiar affection, Mr. Reed.
No, please, dear. Come in, Elaine. Entree. It's our girl from France, Mr. Reeve. Entree. Did you want something, Elaine? Vous voulez quelque chose, dear?
Excuse me, Mrs. Schoen.
Fermez la porte, s'il vous plaît, dear, if you don't mind. Merci. Parce que de Monsieur Schoen's mauvaise épaule, vous savez. Thank you.
A dartboard.
Bah, Pussy. Non. Oh, bah. Bah, Pussy. What was it, Elaine?
The postman has just called, Mrs. Schoen.
Oh, oui. Quelque chose pour moi?
He has delivered a telegram and an unregistered letter. I thought you would wish to have them at once.
There. I said so.
What? What monstrous nonsense.
I said so. J'ai dit.
This house is riddled with superstition, Mr. Reeve. Riddled with it.
Stephen, dear, s'il vous plaît. Je sais que c'est très extraordinaire, peut-être. Mais ce n'est pas la superstition. Vous savez que ce n'est pas...
Constance Schoen, will you, if shout you must, kindly shout at me in the language you have shouted at me in for the past 27 years?
Oh, I'm so sorry. Je suis si confusée. Please forgive me. No, down, Pussy. Elaine, permettez que j'introduce Monsieur Reeve. Mr. Reeve, this is Mademoiselle Moutier.
Enchanté de vous.
How do you do?
Merci. Thank you very much. Oui.
I must just open the telegram, if you'll forgive me. Why, how wonderful. It's from my brother Arthur, Mr. Reeve, General Gland. He's back from the East. Isn't that splendid news?
No.
Oh, excellent. I've often heard you mention him. I always hoped I might have the honor of meeting him.
A hedge.
But of course, you may find him very useful. He and Richard were devoted to each other.
A hedge, a bare ruined choir, Mr. Reeve, where late the sweet birds sang.
We had long hoped for a meeting with Mrs. Schoen's brother, General Gland, though we were well conscious that the occasion might prove an embarrassing one. We need not blink the fact. The question we wished to put to the general concerned his sister's honor. It was a problem that had long obsessed us. For, as we have said elsewhere, within 5 minutes of our first meeting, months before, Mr. Stephen Schoen had hinted at something of which we had till that moment been totally unaware. A sad enough tale, in all conscience.
My wife, Mr. E. My own wife. With my own brother. I would find them in this very chamber, Mr. Reeve, my own bedroom. I was gravely displeased.
This revelation, though to some it must appear shocking, was not altogether baffling in itself. Yet it was clear that Mrs. Schoen had a different recollection of the occasion.
You know, Mr. Reeve, my husband is really a very simple man, quite transparent. I hope you didn't get the idea that Stephen seduced Richard's wife.
No, Mr. Schoen said nothing that even made me suspect such a thing.
No, I'm afraid it was Richard's wife who led Stephen astray. Poor Richard was very upset. He would never enter this house, you know.
Though it was not impossible to reconcile these two assertions, we could not avoid a sense of uncertainty. So that the question all intemperately remained, who did what, when, and with whom? That problem, abhorrent as it may scream to the seamish, that problem we were determined to solve. Our time was short, and there are moments when the scholar, normally a patient beast, feels he must be more downright, more devil-may-care, more earthy even than is his wont. It was in such a mood that we called on General Arthur Dowd Wilbraham Dowd Cork Gland in his Bayswater Hotel, and resolutely rang the bell.
What's that? Well, do come in. Come in, come in. Why not try that, eh? Anybody there? Oh, hello. Good morning to you. Come in.
I'm so sorry, sir. The bell doesn't seem to ring.
Oh, yes. Yes. I heard it.
Oh, I thought it didn't seem to sound.
Oh, yes, I think so. Let's see. Is this it? Did you press the tit or anything?
What? Yes. I'm afraid I pressed it some 5 times in all.
Well, I heard it 5 times. Funny. Well, let's try it again, shall we? You do it. I'll go over there and listen. Now then, ready?
Yes.
Fire! Do it again. Yes, well, yes, I heard that perfectly all right. That makes 7. Very good, really. Yeah, but come in, old boy. Do come in. I'm so glad you came. Dreadful weather, isn't it? Dreadful. So sticky.
Well, actually, it's begun to snow a little.
Dreadful. Might be Rangoon, almost. Still, the weather means sweet damn all to you, doesn't it, Colonel?
Oh, no, really. I know Colonel, General.
Say?
I said I am not Colonel Reeve, sir.
Did you? Why was that?
Well, I'm not. That's all, I'm afraid. I'm not Colonel Reeve.
Oh, dear. But I thought you were old Bimbo Reeve, who made out so marvellous splendid at Tobruk. No?
No, alas. I'm afraid I've no claim to any kind of military distinction whatever.
Why, what were you?
When?
During the war, man, the late conflict. What service were you in?
I'm afraid I wasn't in the armed forces at all, General Gland. I was let off, exempted on medical grounds.
Why?
Well, sir, I'm afraid they discovered that I had flat feet.
Flat feet?
Yes, I fear, sir.
Let's see.
See, General?
Go on, show Uncle.
Well, certainly, sir, if you wish, but of course nothing very much shows, I'm afraid, sir.
Ah, doesn't it? Oh, well, don't bother then. No, man, lace it up. Flat feet.
So, I'm afraid they wouldn't have me in the armed forces.
No?
No.
Well, it's all right by me, you know, old boy. I believe every man has a right to his personal beliefs.
No, it wasn't a question of... I've got flat feet. They said it was absolutely...
Well, I'm the very last person in the world I hope to override a fellow's religious convictions, provided they're sincerely held. Damn it, that was what we were fighting for, they said.
But, sir...
No, please, Mr. Reeve, every sincere thinking man asks himself these questions. Ought to ask them, by golly. Yes, by golly, asked them myself. Put the question often. Always been forced to answer no, of course, but there it is.
But I thought...
There it is. You know, I heard that bell as clearly as I hear you.
Huh?
Tink. Dreadfully faint, of course. If it isn't rude, Mr. Reeve, how long did they put you in for?
In?
Don't think I'm unsympathetic, Mr. Reeve. I know the lavatories in some of these places are in a shocking state. Not that they were up to much in the jungle, if it comes to that. Dreadful it was, you know. Still, the past's past. Well, it's been nice mulling over old times, hasn't it?
Oh, yes. Very.
Yes, really. I've enjoyed it personally, very much. Was there anything else you came about?
Well, I really came in connection with a rather delicate question concerning your brother-in-law, Richard Schoen.
Oh, yes, really, old Dick. Splendid fella. He wrote books, you know. Or they say he did. It may be just hearsay, I suppose. But, you know, he was splendid, really splendid. He made out brilliantly in the 14-18 thing, you know. He got the DSO.
Oh, but, forgive me, sir, but Richard Sherwin never participated in the Great War.
Say?
He had severe mastoid and was never allowed to...
Oh, come, Mr. Reeve, please. I've told you I've every respect for your feelings, but you mustn't try to foist them off onto old Dick. Please, leave poor old Dick Shaw into his glory. Come.
Why,
he mentioned in every dispatch there ever was, he was. Pretty well, huh? Ah, well. Tink. Look, Mr. Reeve.
Yes, sir?
Have you ever met my sister Connie?
Oh, why, yes, it was she who wrote you suggesting I should call.
Did she really? Good for her. Well, you know her husband, old Stephen Schoen.
Yes, of course.
Well, now, look, Mr. Reeve, there's something I've always wondered about. It's a dreadfully delicate question. I hope you won't mind me putting it.
Of course not, sir.
Well, you must have had a lot of experience of odd types in wherever it was they put you. But listen, Now, can you tell me this? I won't let it go any further, of course.
Sir?
It's this. In your candid opinion, which would you say it was? Did old Connie drive old Steve Dotty, or did old Steve drive Connie? It's a problem I can't get off my mind. Because, you see, there's never been anything of that kind on our side of the family. Tink, 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 it said. Tink, 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 tink.
Well, Mr. Reeve, I gather you saw my brother-in-law the other day.
Yes.
Oh, did you, Mr. Reeve?
Yes, indeed, a most agreeable encounter.
Was he like you expected?
Oh, yes, exactly. I feel no doubt now that he's the original of Colonel Thyroid in The Bang and the Whimper.
How charming.
He also appears in a slightly less idealized form as William Acorn, the English keeper of a Japanese tea house in the back and the front.
Stephen!
Oh, I can hardly believe that.
And as you are doubtless aware, he figures in my brother's will as the legatee of all the less seemly pictures in my brother's collection.
Oh, Stephen, dear, I don't think we ought to bring up Richard's will again. Oh, do you, Mr. Reeve? Such a painful document.
Pain I personally have never flinched at, no. I was well prepared, Mr. Reeve. As I have mentioned before, my brother Richard made it quite clear that he intended to leave the whole of his vulgar fortune to the unsavory brood of children begotten by my other brother Edward upon Nancy, his imbecile spouse.
Stephen, I really don't think you should refer to poor Nancy like that.
My dear, isn't it about time you went and made Mr. Reeve a nice pot of hot water?
Oh, yes, I'm so sorry. Yes, of course. I'll ask Elaine to put the kettle on.
The final words of my brother's testament are burned in letters of fire on my brain, Mr. Reeve.
Yes.
The spitefulness of it. And to my dear brother Stephen Showen, I bequeath all my real estate in London and the home counties, my aeroplanes, my Shakespeare first folios, my medicine cupboard, and the performing rights in all my dramatic works. Why, Mr. Reeve, the only tangible object in the whole bequest was the medicine cupboard. Even the Times could not refrain from pointing out that my brother had never possessed any real estate in London, or any aeroplanes, or any Shakespeare first folios to leave to anyone.
Or, of course, any dramatic works.
Well, there, perhaps you are slightly in error, Mr. Reeve.
But do you mean that I...
Mr. Reeve, since you press me so hard, perhaps I should confess to you one of our darker family secrets. My brother did indeed leave one play behind him, alas.
Well, you know, this is splendid news, Mr. Showen.
You would, I fear, think it less splendid had you conned the manuscript and acquainted yourself with the theme of the work.
Mr. Showen, what would the theme of the work be?
The play deals very frankly with a certain subject, Mr. Reeve. Alas.
What subject, Mr. Shine?
Mr. Reeve, as you have gathered, the aspect of himself that my brother presented to the world was but a simulacrum. In your forthright way, you have penetrated beyond that, and who shall say you nay? But beyond that, there was far more. Far more, Mr. Reeve.
How far, Mr. Shine?
My brother's interests and habits were very far-ranging, Mr. Reeve. They were not simply confined to seduction, adultery, and rape. Far from it.
Does the work still exist?
I fear so, Mr. Reeve. I'm afraid I could not undertake the responsibility of showing it to you.
Oh.
I dare say my brother Edward's widow down in Mulsett might be less discreet.
Oh, you think so?
But I hope not.
So, once again, as often before, were we lured down to Mulsett. Leafy Mulsett, the scene of so much of Schoen's life and art. There, at Throbbing, the graceful home he had left them, surely Nancy Schoen and her bright offspring will give us unstintingly of their aid. So would Mulsett itself, that incomparable landscape, clear-rivered, tree-crowded, bird-haunted... Bird haunted?
I know we have the place somewhere or other, Mr. Reeve. I don't think the children destroyed it.
Oh, I hope not.
Oh, don't worry, Mr. Reeve. It'll turn up.
It must be somewhere, because I remember we used it only last Christmas for something else.
Something else?
Yes. You see, it's only typed on one side of the paper, and we use the blank sides for playing heads, bodies, and legs, I remember.
Great God.
Oh, of course, so we did.
And some of them were so funny, we felt we couldn't throw them away immediately. You know how ridiculously one hoards such things.
Oh, I hope so.
Well, I'll go and round up George and Brian, and we'll instigate a mammoth search. See you later.
How very kind of him.
Well, it's very kind of you to take all this interest in dear Richard, Mr. Reeve. I'm sure he would have appreciated it.
Oh, not at all.
He was so gentle and sweet. He was more like a woman than a man, in some ways, I often thought.
Yes?
I suppose Stephen and Connie will have told you a great deal about him.
Yes. Yes, they've been most kind and explicit. But there are still one or two points in his personal relationship that continue to baffle me. In fact, Mrs. Schoen...
It's so horrid when things prey on the mind, isn't it? I have my own problems, too.
Oh, I'm very sorry to hear that.
Well, of course, it's little Humphrey, really. He has rather a strong character, as I expect you've noticed.
Yes.
But he's a very sincere boy, and I know he genuinely means it when he says he wants to become a J.D.
A J.D.?
Yes, a juvenile delinquent. I wonder if you could help me a little with him.
Well, I could talk to him... Try to dissuade him?
No, I don't want him to be dissuaded. It may be only a passing craze, but I do think he should be allowed to work his way naturally through it.
Well, that is a point, of course.
Yes, I felt it was rather a point. I felt that.
Mrs. Schoen, there is one question concerning Richard Schoen which I feel sure you could help me about.
Well, of course, if I can, of course.
I expect you're aware that there's one side of Richard's domestic relationships that the great world so far knows nothing at all about.
Well, yes, I suppose they don't.
I hope to be the first to tell the world the truth.
Yes, I see. Mr. Reeve, what I've been wondering is whether you'd be willing to have Humphrey with you in London for a time.
Humphrey? In London?
Yes, you see, there's very little scope for a juvenile delinquent in the country, and I thought you might know some select little gang he might go round with for a time.
Well, Mrs. Schoen, I can only say I shall have to think very deeply about the matter.
Thank you. It's so kind of you.
Mrs. Schoen, forgive my reverting to the matter, but it has been very strongly hinted to me that all was not quite as it has hitherto been supposed to have been... between Richard Schoen and his brother's wife.
No, no, of course not.
I have had two conflicting accounts. One from Stephen, one from Mrs. Stephen. Now, dear Mrs. Schoen, I wonder if you'll be willing to help me to the real truth. I do hope you're not offended by mentioning all this.
No, no. I felt you were bound to mention it sooner or later.
I'm only anxious to discover the truth.
Mr. Reeve, I will tell you the truth. I hope you will believe it.
Oh, but of course.
I don't know how much the others have said, but it was one Christmas. Richard was down here by himself. The place was his, of course, in those days, and he'd asked myself and the children here for Christmas. There were only about 8 of them at the time. He was so good to them.
Of course.
Well, anyhow, there he was. Rather sad, I thought he seemed, that Christmas. And it was while my husband was away in Turkey. And Richard and I were both, well, rather lonely. That was what it was, I suppose. I remember we used to walk round the park together, rather like the two people in that poem. Dans le vieux parc solitaire et glacé, deux ghosts ont évoqué le passé. I went to a finishing school in France, you know, near Bougival.
You were about to say something, Mrs. Schoen.
Oh, well, only that was how it happened. I was terribly sorry afterwards, of course. After all, I was chairman of the Women's Institute that year, and there was the choir, and one has one's obligations. But, well, Richard was lonely, and I was lonely, and there it was. It didn't seem such a very serious thing at the time.
Mrs. Schoen, you mean... You?
And it wasn't serious, really. I don't know what the others have told you, Mr. Reeve. In fact, until you said so, I never realized they knew. But I do give you my solemn word of honor that it was only the once.
The once?
Oh, yes, that I could swear to.
Even bravest heart may swell. That has been well said. And it may well be added that even bravest heart may, on occasion, contract. This was perhaps such a moment. It did indeed seem to us that though we had just unearthed a new and arresting fact, it was not a fact that solved our earlier problem. Rather, indeed, did it complicate it. Perhaps we would do better for the moment to turn our attention to the purely literary problem that confronted us. Schoen's unknown play.
We found it!
We found Uncle Richard's play.
It's a bit battered and tattered, I'm afraid, Mr. Reed. But you're a fan of Uncle's. You won't mind that.
Of course not.
It's a jolly good play.
Oh, I hope you won't mind about the heads, bodies, and legs on the backs of some of the pages.
Oh, no. Thank goodness it survives.
I think most of it's there.
Most?
Yes, I don't think there's much of it missing.
And it's ever such an interesting play, Mr. Reed.
Here, then, it was. It had not been difficult to come by after all. Only a title page was lacking. It did not perhaps very greatly resemble any of those novels that have earned for Schoen the title of The Poet's Novelist. But how should it? This was not a novel, but a play. And, ah, heavens, how moving the experience! To see from the very first page how complete a master Schoen had made himself of the technique of the lovely art of drama. As we conned the opening moments of Act One, we could instantaneously and inescapably conjure up the theatric image. Act One.
The drawing room of Roger Waterson's flat in Cavendish Square. Tastefully furnished. Grand piano back left, Picasso Harlequin in frame over it. Large window in middle of left wall. Downstage of this, door to dining room. Door to corridor, back center. Between this and right wall, low bookcase. Over it, reproduction of Correggio's Ganymede. Fireplace in center of right wall, sofa left center, near piano, small table with telephone. At rise of curtain, discovered Mrs. Bannister, the daily help, on knees, tidying grate. After a few moments, telephone rings. She gets up, crosses upstage left, and picks up receiver.
Hello? Yes, it is. Who's that, please?
Grimly.
Oh, it's you again, is it? What I say, it's you again. Well, is it or isn't it? Well, keep a civil tongue if you've got one. No, I'm not. No, he's not. No, we're none of us not. What? No, he isn't. I couldn't say. You could always leave a message. Kindly don't refer to Mr. Waterson like that in my presence. You knew that I'm...
Roger Waterson has just entered from corridor, back center.
Oh, sir.
Roger has his hat and coat on. His features are weary and unshaven, as though he had not been to bed. As soon as she sees him, Mrs. Bannister claps hand over telephone.
Who is it, Mrs. Bannister?
Oh, sir, it's him again.
Pause.
I see.
What shall I say, sir?
Pause.
Say I'm not at home.
Mr. Waterson is not at home. What?
Whispers loudly.
Sir, he says he heard you.
I see.
Crosses L and takes telephone from Mrs. Bannister.
Thank you, Mrs. Bannister. Perhaps you could get me some tea.
Yes, sir. And oh, sir, I am so sorry.
That's all right. Thank you.
Mrs. Bannister crosses downstage R, turns at door, shakes head, and exits.
Hello? Yes, I thought we'd agreed that you were not to ring up again. Of course I meant it. I'm very sorry, I can't help that. I'm afraid not.
Firmly.
I'm afraid not. I should have thought you knew why.
Between his teeth.
Goodbye.
Replaces receiver.
A phrase we had somewhere heard or read came into our mind. Sense of theatre. A phrase which somehow or other we had hitherto found it difficult to pin any particular meaning to. But now we understood, fully, what a fine, sensitive, expressive phrase it was. Sense of theatre. Yes, indeed.
Did you like Uncle's play, Mr. Reeve?
Very much, Brian, thank you.
It's a jolly interesting play, isn't it?
Oh, very.
Pity there aren't any girls in it, though, isn't it?
Well, that might be a criticism, yes.
Well, I mean, it's not much like Shakespeare, is it?
No, Brian, that's quite true. It isn't greatly like Shakespeare.
Oh, well, there are songs in Shakespeare, just like in this.
Songs, eh? I didn't notice any songs.
Oh, yes, there's one in Act Two. Look, I'll show you.
Old Owen's written a tune for it.
Yes, there it is.
Oh, well, that isn't actually meant to be set to music, Ern. You see, it just says, Roger reads aloud from book.
Yes, I see. Pity.
Still, you'd like to hear old Owen sitting, wouldn't you, Mr. Reeve?
Oh, rather, yes.
Well, I thought it ought to have an accompaniment on this thing. Quite a lot of actors can play them.
Yes, I suppose so.
Would you mind reading out the words for me, Mr. Reeve, please, just to jog my memory?
Certainly. Roger reads aloud from book. There once was a garden where we used to play, but the flowers bloom there no more. There are no bright faces at the windows, and the weeds grow up to the door. Unable to go on, Roger gets up and puts the book aside.
Yes, I didn't actually set that last bit, only the lyric. This is how I thought it might be treated.
There once was a garden where we used to play, but the flowers, they don't bloom there no more. There ain't no bright faces at them old windows, not as I can see, boss. And the weeds grows up to the door. Weeds grow right up the old home door. Them old weeds. Oh, gee, ain't that a terrible sad thing? They gone right up on that old home door. Boss?
Yes, I see. Yes. Thank you, Owen.
Nostalgic, really?
Yes, very.
Of course, you have to be very careful with that type of lyric. It can be done, of course, but you have to be very careful with it.
As Mr. Sherne had observed, the play did unquestionably deal with a certain subject. Perhaps that was why its author had withheld it from the world. The play was, at first sight, far better suited to a small, limited, printed edition to be published, let us say, in Amsterdam.
Yes, Mr. Reeve, I'm glad it was my sister-in-law and not myself who placed the disillusioning document in your hands.
Oh, I'm in no way disillusioned, Mr. Sherne. I think it's a splendid play.
I mean your disillusionment about my brother's true character.
Oh, but I know the play deals very sympathetically with a certain subject, but I cannot regard it in any way as autobiographical.
Can you not, Mr. Reeve?
No.
Oh. Tell me, Mr. Reeve, is your biography of Miss Hilda Tablet to be equally evasive?
I don't know quite what you mean, Mr. Sherne.
Indeed. Well, let us dismiss the topic, shall we?
Yes.
My brother-in-law, General Gland, was telling us you had been in prison for a brief period, Mr. Reeve.
What?
Oh, please, Mr. Reeve, don't think I hold it against you. It might perhaps have been easier for my dear wife and myself had we had the confession from your own lips. But we all have our reticences.
But, Mr. Sherwin, I do...
Mr. Reeve, welcome back.
Oh, thank you. Good afternoon.
I do hope you don't mind having coffee for tea, Mr. Reeve.
Hedge backwards, a dartboard.
Our French girl left us, you know. We have a Greek girl from Greece at the moment. She's very nice, of course. And, of course, my Greek is improving a great deal. But she won't let us drink tea. She insists on our drinking, oh, such a lot of coffee. And, oh, so strong and black. Gato, Psipsina. We hardly sleep at all. Her name is Jocasta.
Ah, a good classical name.
Oh, very. And how was Malsit, Mr. Reeve?
Oh, charming as ever. Delightful.
I had a letter from Nancy this morning. She says you've invited Humphrey to stay in London with you. So very kind of you, Mr. Reeve. And how very like you.
Yes.
Well, Mr. Sherwin, I'm afraid she's exaggerating a little there. I do assure you that I would find it quite impossible to cope with Humphrey either in Mulsett or in London.
Oh, I'm sure you'll get used to him. Cut up, Sipsina.
It may be thought by some that we behaved ungratefully in refusing, at any rate for the moment, to further Humphrey's legitimate ambitions. But life was beginning to close in on us again. Only that afternoon, when we returned home, we found a message awaiting us in an unmistakable handwriting.
Dearest Bertie, back. Longing to see you. Come for supper tomorrow, Thursday, 6:30. Bring my life with you. Longing to see you. Neville Pikelet also coming. All love, etc. Tablet.
Thus it was that we found ourselves repairing on the following evening to the familiar flat in Coptic Street. Hilda was a splendid colour.
Bertie, old son. Well, well, well. Lovely to see you.
Lovely to see you, Hilda.
You're still looking a bit pale, Bertie. Mustn't do that, you know. Dangerous. Well, old boy, how's my life? Brought it with you?
Yes, it's in my satchel. Here.
Let's have a deco at it before Neville Pikelet gets here, shall we?
Here.
Thanks. Bertie, old duck, is this all you've done?
Well, I work rather slowly these days, Hilda.
Clearly. I shall have to think of getting someone else at this rate.
Oh, do you think so, Hilda?
No, 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 old son, I was only joking. Don't you worry.
Oh.
Elsa, stop that and come and get Bertie a drink.
Yes?
Have a drink, Bertie, while I take this into a corner and calmly face up to truth about humble self.
Ah, Mr. Reed, how nice to see you. I hope you did not overwork.
No, he didn't.
Good. Gin with tonic and lemon and ice.
Thank you. I hope you enjoyed Marrakesh, Elsa.
It had for and against. Have you ever eaten roast hump of camel and custard, Mr. Reeve?
No. It sounds very filling.
Yes, it is filling, if you can keep it down. But only if...
Elsa, excuse my ignorance, but who is Mr. Pikelet? Hilda says he's coming this evening.
But you remember him. He produced for me my opera, Emily Butter.
Oh, of course, how stupid of me. Yes, are he and Hilda friends again, then?
Bosom.
What?
Bosom. This.
Oh, of course. Good.
Yes. He is going to produce Antony and Cleopatra of Shakespeare with loud music from Hilda.
Oh, excellent.
Herbert?
Yes, Hilda?
Will you come here a moment, Herbert? Look, Herbert. I've been writing music now for some 32 years. And I'm quite used to having my work sent up.
Sent up, Hilda?
That was what I said, Herbert.
Sent up where, Hilda? For some sort of prize, do you mean?
Please, Herbert, don't joke about this. Kindly allow me to read you your opening sentence. In the sphere of music, female composition is a recent development and a healthy one to boot.
Let me see. Oh, no, 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 Hilda. A comma has got left out.
Comma? Where?
There. It should read... Female composition is a recent development and a healthy one, comma, to boot.
You sure?
Well, of course, Hilda.
Well, let's hope the rest of it's a bit more careful. Have you been doing any more about old Dick Schoen?
A little, Hilda, a very little.
Haven't been mousing round old Stephen Schoen again, I hope?
I have seen him on occasion, yes.
Nasty old alligator.
Hilda, did you know that Richard Schoen wrote a play?
Play? Old Dick? Good Lord.
I... have been privileged to see a copy.
Do I come in it?
I think not, Hilda.
I expect I do, really. Got it on you?
Yes, it's in my satchel. Would you care to glance at it?
Of course.
There it is.
Well, fancy old Dick writing a play. Any music called for in it?
Well, yes and no.
Good. I'll set it.
Mr. Pikelet has arrived, Miss Tablet.
Oh, thank you, Mrs. P.
Hilda, my dear.
Oh, dear old Neville, so glad you made it. Mind my tie. Now, you know Bertie Reeve, of course, don't you?
Oh, yes, of course. Lovely to see you again. How do you do?
What will you drink, Neville?
Whiskey, dear, please, and lots and lots of water.
Elsa tells me you're about to embark on Antony and Cleopatra, Mr. Pikelet.
God, yes. Oh, Hilda, darling, I've had such a terrible day.
Who with?
The management. They don't want Pug.
I don't think I remember who Pug is, do I, Neville?
Of course you do, darling. Pug Judder.
Who is he?
He's my Antony, dear. We must have an American. We must have Pug Judder.
I see.
He's big, and he's large, and he has the obvious advantage of having only been in musicals so far. It means he comes to it fresh.
Oh, yes.
And not only does he come to it fresh, he brings to it what it's already got. You see, lovey, in this day and age, Mark Antony has got to be played butch.
Don't you agree, Betty?
What was the word you used?
Butch. Mm. The costumes would help with all that, of course. We're dating the thing forward to around 1805. It makes the whole thing more universal.
Yeah.
And, of course, it brings out the parallel with Nelson and Lady Hamilton.
Yes, I suppose it would.
One has to try and wipe out all memories of previous productions completely.
I think my music may help a bit there, Neville.
Oh, but of course, darling. The opening's going to be marvellous. Pitch darkness. And then the Sphinx's opening monologue suddenly booming out, you know, with the music in the background.
I thought you said the music was going to be in the foreground.
Well, it'll actually be everywhere, really, you know. And the Sphinx's voice will suddenly come booming out of it, and we open with that speech about the thing, the poop she sat on, like a burnished poop burned on the water, the sails were beaten gold, and all the files and mustards of the war glowed like a strumpet's poop, and so on, you know.
Yes.
I may say the music is going to be a pretty sharp smack for the Consolidated Instrumentalists' so-called union.
How have you managed that?
Conkers.
Conkers, Hilda?
Musique concrète. Concrete music. You know about it?
No.
You tape it.
Tape it?
And dub it to disc after. Of course, most of the Johnnies who do it rely on pure sound, amplified and speeded up and reversed and so on. Needless to say, I have my own little line on the thing. For one thing, I think the discerning listener could probably tell you almost at once that my musique concrète is very much louder than anybody else's.
Is it really?
Oh, yes, quite a bit. Also, for fair measure, I clamp in a few simple little haunting tunes of my own. That's why my own brand is called musique concrète renforcée. Reinforced concrete music. Like to hear the block I've done for Antony and Cleopatra?
Oh, very much.
You mind hearing it again, Neville?
Of course not. I have to get used to it.
The opening section is very largely based on Elsa Zip.
Zip?
Yep. Elsa? Come in here.
I'm coming.
I'll show you how we started.
What is it, Hilda? What do you want?
Elsa, are you eating?
A little.
What have you got in your hand?
It is a small calf's kidney.
Elsa, you disgusting girl. It's not cooked.
They are very good and delicious raw also.
Save me, dear God. Kindly turn round.
So?
Now, Bertie, you see this zip fastener?
Hmm?
Now, note the sound it makes when I pull it sharply down like this. Elsa, don't be silly. Now, the sound it makes when pulled up is quite perceptibly different. So...
Oh.
Elsa, do you mind? Thank you.
I shall go back.
Hear the difference, Neville?
Not quite. Could you do them again?
Okay. Listen. Now up again. Listen.
Oh! I have nearly swallowed this kidney wholesale.
Well, don't show it to people, you silly little dotty. Take the beastly thing into the kitchen.
I am at my end of the tethers. I shall go back on the first train to Vienna. I will.
Those kidneys were our supper boys, believe it or not.
Oh.
Where was I? Oh, yes. Now, that zip was invaluable in suggesting a certain effect. Wind whipping across desert sand. Of course, I treated it. I'll put on the first fragment for you. This is how the play opens. Nice, isn't it, Neville?
Yes, very.
Like it, Bertie?
Yes, very much.
Stimulating. Now I'll put on a quiet a bit.
Oh, thank you.
This is more thoughtful in character.
Yes. Hilda, what's that sort of glub-glub sound I hear?
Ah, I'm glad you noticed that. It's my housekeeper's heart. It's rather dicky. That's her husband's. His is all right.
Haven't seen much of you lately, Mr. Reeve, but I expect you're busy with your book on dear Richard. Oh, down, darling.
Well, I make but scant progress, I fear.
I expect you're kept pretty well to heel by Miss Tablet.
Well,
does she inflict her bohemian friends upon you, Mr. Reeve?
Not really. I did meet the theatrical producer, Mr. Neville Pikelet, there recently.
Ah, yes, of course, Mr. Pikelet. Did he divulge to you his astonishing theatrical project?
Oh, yes, in some detail. I suppose Antony and Cleopatra in Napoleonic dress might be interesting. One has to be broad-minded in these things.
You'll have to be even more broad-minded than that, Mr. Reeve. Mr. Pikelet has abandoned Antony and Cleopatra. He has been unable to secure the services of an American impersonator, named, if I recall it aright, Hog Kidder.
But may I ask how you know this, Mr. Schoen?
He wrote and told me.
Oh, I didn't know you knew him.
I don't, Mr. Reeve. But he intends a presentation of my brother's play, so dear to your heart, in lieu of Shakespeare's tragedy.
What?
Isn't it delightful news, Mr. Reeve? And we have you to thank for it.
Me?
It appears that Miss Tablet passed on the manuscript you pressed upon her to Mr. Pikelet, with the result I have indicated.
Well, this is all very surprising, of course, but I hardly think you will be allowed to do it.
Oh, why ever not, Mr. Reeve?
The play deals with a certain subject, Mrs. Schoen.
Mr. Pikelet seems undeterred by that.
But, Mr. Schoen, do you really think that the play should be done?
Why not, Mr. Reeve?
Well, I was thinking of Richard's reputation.
Who are we to blind the eyes of posterity, Mr. Reeve? I would rather have the truth, Mr. Reeve, than a coronet of rubies.
Yes, yes, it is better.
And besides, you see, Mr. Reeve, if the play is done, my husband will get all the money for it.
Constance!
Oh, yes, I recall. Yes, the terms of Schoen's will cover that, of course. Yes, I see.
And you see, Mr. Reeve, it would be such a very great help to us. We might be able to afford a real permanent English maid, then. Our foreign ones never seem to stay. We have a girl from Greenland at present, a Miss Erbia. She does her very best. She re-roofed the whole of the house, single-handed, almost the minute she came here. But the fact remains that she will apparently expect to be allowed to sleep all through the winter months. Of course, the pussies love to snuggle up to her, and she does give off a surprising amount of warmth. But nothing is ever quite ideal, is it?
Play simply must be done. It's wonderful. Of course, there'll have to be a few pretty drastic rewrites, but that's never difficult once a play's in rehearsal.
You and I could do those, Bertie.
But do you mean you'd alter Schoen's text?
But my dear, let's face it, nobody's going to stand for a play on that subject, having a happy ending. Well, I mean, the thought of the two of them living happily ever after. You can't possibly suggest that. I mean, take that big scene between Roger and Billy. No one's going to get away with that as it stands, are they?
Well, but in that case, I don't see how the play can be done at all.
It's quite simple. You just turn Billy into a girl, you know?
Into a girl?
Yes, I swear to you, Bertie. Make Billy a girl, tidy it up a bit, and it'll work like a charm.
I think the three of us can make the whole thing a splendid collaboration. After all, my Antony and Cleopatra music will fit into pretty well any play.
Yes, possibly.
I've set the song already. Elsa? Did it as a sort of act of homage to old Dick. Come on, Elsa. What have you been doing?
I have been packing my bag.
Silly girl. There's lobster for lunch.
That I don't wish to know.
Come and let's give them that song I wrote last night. You boys do want to hear it, I take it?
Yes, rather, certainly.
Once a garden where we used to play, but the flowers bloom there no more. There are no bright faces everywhere in those entries.
Elsa, get off that note.
I see.
Thank you, Hilda.
Nostalgic, really?
Yes.
Is it to be hot lobster or cold, Hilda?
Hot.
Good.
You know, I had a rather brilliant idea about that song last night. I think we could give it to Roger's mother. She could sing it at the piano on the stage by herself, and Roger could come in halfway through and stand there, terribly moved, watching her, you know.
Who'd you cast for it? Quite a difficult piece.
I've an idea for that, too. I've been dying to have old Daisy Treadle in something for ages. I'm terribly fond of the old girl, and she would be a terrific draw, even now.
Daisy Treadle? Why, she was singing in damn silly musical comedies when I was in short pants.
Maybe, darling, but she's still got what it takes.
Well, I can't think where she can have put it in that case.
What I suggest you do, Hilda, is straighten the song out a bit on paper and put it into E-flat.
E-flat? Does that thing still exist?
And I swear to you, it will come out just like Elsa does it. Old Daisy always has been good at sliding a bit off-key, you know.
Never, my dear. I do love you. Don't think I don't. But I sometimes begin to think that the sort of things some people sometimes say to me are the sort of things you'd hardly think anybody would ever say to anybody.
Our grave doubts about the advisability of presenting Schoen's play did for a time persist. Curiously enough, they remained undispelled by the admittedly skillful manipulations imposed upon the text by Mr. Pikelet, by Hilda, by the leading actor Mr. Michael Pebble, and by Miss Daisy Treadle. It came as a surprise to hear ourselves sometimes congratulated on these changes, but let it not be thought by the library pedant that the presentation of a play is a simple matter. The literary purist hugging his cherished author's text may have his views, but others have theirs also. We were to hear a number.
I assure you, Mr. Reeve, I shall raise no finger against my brother's play. Let him be known for what he was. Truth shall be truth always.
Our doubts were further undermined by a recurrent leitmotif in the converse of Mrs. Stephen Schoen.
It's so exciting, isn't it, Mr. Reeve? I'm sure the first night will be delightful. I'm lining a special basket for pussies because Mr. Pikelet has promised us a box. He says provided they're quiet, it'll be all right for them to come. And they've promised. And, oh, Mr. Reeve, we've heard of such a good maid. English, from Stratford-on-Avon.
Doubt we had also expressed to Mrs. Nancy Schoen when she came up to London one day with a number of her sons.
Yes, it is exciting, isn't it? I'm so delighted. It's wonderful about Owen, isn't it? Mr. Pikelet has let him set those very pretty words to music.
It's not the actual setting I sang to you, of course, Mr. Reeve. For one thing, Miss Treadle can't play the guitar.
Though I'm sure Owen would have been very happy to play it for her.
So I've written a new one. A faintly period flavour, you know. It was jolly nice of Miss Tablet to stand down, wasn't it?
Yes, very. They are, of course, using her music in the intervals.
Yes. She said she'd stop at nothing to see the play had the best possible starting conditions. You know, that's a jolly decent spirit, Mr. Reeve.
Oh, how lovely it all is. I'm so glad you came down and unearthed the play. And how glad you must be, too.
Yes. Our thoughts and opinions had much that was selfish in them, it appeared, when we compared them with those of all the people who depended so much upon the success of Schoen's play. We needed a more objective view, but where to turn for it? Suddenly, a thought struck us. We would repair once more to Schoen's old friend, General Arthur Gland, still happily back from the East. He had spoken as Schoen's friend before. We would try to persuade him to do so again.
Of course, I remember you.
Splendid face. Reeve, isn't it? Yes, that's right, Reeve. I was terribly sorry for you. Dreadful thing. Almost wrote to the papers about it. Nice to see you. When did they let you out again?
Out?
I absolutely loathe any form of persecution. Hate it. Was there anything special you came about, or was it just for a drink?
I wondered if you'd mind my calling to chat once more about Richard Schoen.
I say, do you remember that bell?
Bell?
Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. It kept going. Tremendous loud peals, I recall.
What I wanted to ask you was if you knew that a play by Richard Schoen was about to be presented in Shaftesbury Avenue.
No, really? Well, by golly, that's splendid. Oh, I'm so glad. I love the theatre. I could go every night. It's a great power for good. Did you know that? Ding dong, ding dong, ding dong. Yes, spanking good news about old Dick. There's nothing like the theatre for a man with a good message. Have you seen a play called Sailor Beware?
No, not yet.
Ah, now that had a very good message, I thought. Has old Dick Schoen's play got a good message?
It was about that I came to see you, sir.
Ah.
You see, sir, I am personally of the opinion that Schoen's play should not be performed.
Reeve. I am very, very sorry to hear you say that. I like you very much personally, always have, and I know what you've been through. But, my dear good man, for God's sake, don't let it warp you. Here's Dick Schoen, a splendid fellow, secure in his glory. There's old Dick, there's his glory. And what do you do to his glory, Reeve? Pardon me for saying so. Why, at every turn you try to undermine it. Don't do it, Reeve. It's not worth it. It's not worth it. When a man has glory, we should try to add to that glory, ding-dong. Why, I loved old Dick. And I have to say it does gall me to hear the way every time you come here, you try to take the mickey out of him. No, let's leave him alone in his glory, like Sir John Moore at Corunna, with whom he had so much in common. Let us say no more about it.
No, very well.
I hope you don't mind my speaking so plainly.
No. It was rather what I hoped to hear.
Well, so long as I've helped in any way, that's all that matters. Ding dong. If you're free, we might walk across the park together.
Yes, I should like that very much.
Have to go to a bespoke bookmaker's near the bottom of Park Lane. Might like to accompany me. Always have to get my shoes made specially, you know. Dreadful expense, of course, but ever since I was a child, I've suffered terribly from flat feet. Oh, martyr to them in a very real sense.
The first night of Schoen's play has now passed into theatrical history. There were those who declared that there had been nothing like it since the first night of Emily Butter a year earlier at Covent Garden. Such a comparison serves little purpose, and we do but mention it. Though it may well have been suggested by the intermittent presence of Hilda's music, precipitated about the auditorium by means of loudspeakers. Our own part in the preparations had been, after all, a very small one. Yet we had a gratifying sense of feeling needed.
Mr. Reeve, there is one thing I would ask you carefully to look into.
Well, naturally, anything I can do...
It is simply this, Mr. Reeve. I know that Miss Tablet is having much to do with the work, and that you are her all but inseparable friend. But if my health should spare me to attend the initial performance, I do hope you will see that she is not allowed to molest me in any way. I have had a hard life. I do not wish its hardships added to.
No, I will do my best.
I am but a hedge, Mr. Reeve, a burnt flower bed, and sometimes a dartboard also.
Hilda's own sentiments about a possible meeting were scarcely less ardent.
And look, Bertie, if old Stephen Schoen rears his ugly head on the first night, just you stuff him in your overcoat pocket and leave him in the cloaks. Get a ticket for him, and then, if possible, lose it, see?
Yes, Hilda.
Thank you.
We ourselves sat with Hilda and Mr. Pikelet in one of the upper boxes. Our struggles and arguments were over. The strain of rehearsal was no more. The play had been transferred from us into the devoted guardianship of the cast. And one and all, the cast was giving of its splendid best.
Only you see, Jenny, there were sometimes moments during the war when I sort of did wonder a bit.
Oh, Roger, wasn't that a bit awful on me?
Yes, I know it was. I'm sorry. Only sometimes, when you were 5,000 feet up there, suddenly you sometimes felt a sort of vast uncertainty all round you.
I don't think I understand.
It was rather as if... Oh, damn it, Jenny, I'm no damn good at putting things into words. I'm not one of those poet chaps. Sometimes wish I was.
Oh, no, Roger. I like you much better as you are. You're more reliable.
No, Jenny, this is frightfully important. You see, there was a chap I knew in the RAF. He was my rear gunner for a time. He used to write poetry. We all liked him. He was obviously frightfully miserable a lot of the time, but he cheered us all up somehow.
Do go on.
I remember every time we crossed the German coast on the way out, how he used to grin and say, "Christ, Roger, I'm bloody frightened."
I hate cowards. I believe God hates them too.
Well, I don't know, Jenny. I believe he understands them.
Well, I don't, so there.
You know, you're pretty hard sometimes, aren't you, Jenny?
I don't think so. Do go on.
But, Jenny, darling, old Nicky wasn't a coward.
He sounds like one.
Jenny, cowards don't die in action firing a 4-5 machine gun.
Oh, Roger, I'm so sorry.
That's all right, Jenny.
No, come back, Roger. Come and sit here. Do go on about Nicky. He sounds nice.
He was the sincerest man I ever knew, apart from my father and mother. Well, one morning when we were coming back after knocking Hamburg about a bit, just as we crossed the coast onto the home ground, he looked down and said, "By God, those folks down there are damn splendid, aren't they?" And, of course, I thought about you being down there too, and somehow I found myself telling him about you and me.
Do go on.
I sort of explained to him how we hardly ever saw each other, and how it was sometimes natural for a jealous bastard like me to wonder if someone else mightn't step in while I was away. And he said, "Roger, it mustn't ever make any difference to you, even if there is anyone else."
Nicky said that?
Yes. I knew he was a poet, but up to then he'd never spouted any of his own stuff at me, and suddenly he began to. He said, "It mustn't make any difference at all, Roger. Mark my words," he said. "Love is not love which alters when it alteration finds, or bends with the remover to remove. Oh, no."
Oh, no! It is an ever-fixed mark that looks on tempests and is never shaken. It is the star to every wandering bark. Oh, Roger.
You mean you knew old Nicky?
You know about him?
Yes.
They're all loving it.
Are they? Oh.
Do you know what I think?
What?
If we're not jolly careful, we're going to have a success on our hands.
Certainly, after Act Two, there could be no doubt of the mounting excitement of the audience. The evening has, of course, passed into theatrical history and will be forgotten by none who are present. We ourselves cherish few warmer recollections than of that moment in Act Three when Miss Daisy Treadle entered, that Miss Treadle who had already enchanted two generations of playgoers and was now proceeding to enchant a fourth. First night accidents are well known in the theatre, but with what ready art Miss Treadle turned even these to account. When, after a skillfully prolonged navigation of the full stage from upright to down left, she gracefully subsided, not onto the piano stool, but onto the beautiful Indian carpet somewhat to the left of it, none will have guessed that this was not a calculated artifice. With what an admirable expression of baffled maternal sadness, she gazed searchingly round the stalls, dragged herself slowly up from the floor, onto the piano stool, and addressed herself to the instrument, which had, and how much it contributed to the magic of the scene, already been playing for a little over a minute.
"Once was a garden where we used to play, but the flowers bloomed there no more. There are no bright flowers.
windows, there's no smoke rising from those dear chimneys. Oh, where are the roses around the door? My sweetheart,
Mother.
Do you know what has been in my thoughts all this night, my dear William?
I can guess, Mother.
Neville, why on earth did she call him William?
Oh, that was just a fluff. Don't say anything to her about it. We don't want to undermine her sense of security.
No, I suppose not. She has got one, has she?
Oh, stupendous. Yeah.
You make me feel very ashamed, Mother.
Who is this young girl who's got such a grip on you, Harry?
The great climax of Act Three held the audience spellbound by content and manner alike. How one felt it strike home. It was clearly the first time for many, many years that an English audience had heard such language in the theatre.
But, Roger, my dear, it would never work. It just wouldn't work, Roger.
We'd make it work, Jenny.
No, Roger. You see, I'm frightened.
Frightened of what? Of me?
I'm just frightened we might hurt each other. Terribly. People do.
But not us, Jenny.
Yes, Roger, even us.
Well, what if we did?
Oh, no, Roger, it would be terrible. I don't think I could bear it.
I could.
You're a man. I'm...
That doesn't matter, Jenny. Jenny, it's not really me you're frightened of, is it?
No. I don't know. I don't think so.
And it's not yourself.
I don't know, Roger. I just don't know.
No, Jenny. It's life itself you're frightened of. Life itself. And that's the thing we must never be frightened of. Life. Come and look out of the window, Jenny. Come and see all those people down there, rushing about, fretful, anxious, worried, nervous, jumpy, and all of them frightened of life. You mustn't be like them, Jenny. Nor must I. It would be the great betrayal, Jenny. The law may be against us, Jenny, but ordinary people aren't.
I thought we'd taken that line out.
We did, but he asked if he could put it back. He said he found it helped him.
How?
With the build, dear boy.
Roger.
No, Jenny, don't answer it. Let it ring. Let it ring, Jenny.
Let it ring.
Jenny, thank God.
Oh, my dear, thank God. God.
The immense popular success of the play is now, of course, a matter of theatrical history. We were not quite to know how certain a draw it would be for a few days yet. But during the splendid party given in the Stalls Bar after the performance, there was already that unmistakable sense of accomplishment, of success, of happy collaboration brought to fruition. Tomorrow, and in the succeeding days, we would also know how well the play had gone down with the critics, that helpful body. The Times reviewed the play at length and spoke knowledgeably of Schoen's novels. The Daily Telegraph, under the headline, Novelist's Play in Verse, said that it would be of special interest to Schoen's devoted band of readers. The News Chronicle said that it was, fatally, a novelist play. The Daily Mail said that it was, like most novelist plays, a novelist play. The Daily Express, under the headline, No Business Like Schoen Business, gave some interesting details of the advance booking and of Miss Daisy Treadle's recent divorce. The Manchester Guardian said, It suffers a little from being written by a novelist, unlike most plays, which suffer from being written by dramatists. The Daily Mirror said, I laughed till the tears came, but am still not sure if this is what novelist Schoen intended. The Observer had a long and thoughtful review under the headline, Half-Brecht House. The Sunday Times said it was, thank God, a novelist's play. The Evening Standard said, if I had to choose between this and Salad Days, it would be a hard choice for me, and reproduced a photograph of Miss Daisy Treadle. The Evening News said that it was a thumping bad play by a thumping bad novelist, and reproduced a photograph, also thought at first to be Miss Daisy Treadle, but later identified as the dramatic critic himself. But this was for the future, albeit the near future. At the moment, we could but simply and relievedly enjoy ourselves there in the beautiful Circle Bar.
So nice, so very nice. And how nice everyone's been to Owen. I'm so pleased, Mr. Reeve.
That old lady sang Owen's song a fair treat, didn't she, Mr. Reeve?
Beautiful, beautiful.
And Owen's going to play it for us in a minute. They've asked him to.
And Pussies were so good. We managed to catch Muffy again after all. She was at the back of the gallery.
I thought that telephone was absolutely marvelous, you know. And such a splendid message, too.
And oh, Mr. Reeve, it is so wonderful. I've spoken to the booking manager, and he says he's very hopeful.
Only one fear momently assailed us in this happy gathering, lest we should betray our trust to Mr. Stephen Schoen and to Hilda. They must, we knew, not meet. Imagine then our horror when we suddenly looked up to see them steadily approaching each other from a distance of about 20 feet. Nay, more, they were...
Well, my dear Miss Tablet, how enchanting to see you again after all these years.
Stephen, my dear, I do take that a bit hard, Miss Tablet, indeed.
Hilda, my dear girl, Hilda.
Steve, after all these years, do we kiss?
Of course we kiss, Hilda, of course we do.
We were present on this occasion.
Be careful, dear. Mind my tie.
Oh, I'm so sorry, Hilda. And it's a very pretty tie, my dear.
Like it? I ran it up myself. It's chiffon. You don't think it looks a bit sissy or anything, do you?
Nothing could look sissy on you, Hilda.
Dear old Steve, I must give you another kiss. The hell with reputation.
And you mind my tie this time, Hilda, dear.
Beauty. The beauty of reconciliation. The most beautiful thing in the world. And we are never to know where it will break out next.
Look, Steve, I tell you what.
What?
Those boys and girls over there are going to sing that god-awful song in a minute. How about joining in, eh?
Why, certainly, Hilda. I love a damn good sing-song.
Steve.
Huh?
Forgive me if I say it, Steve. But you looked a bit like old Dick as you said that.
Oh, really, Hilda?
Really, Steve?
Oh, Hilda, how nice of you to say it. It makes me feel really proud. I still miss him, you know, dear old Dick. My dear, dear brother.
Now once was a garden where we used to play, but the flowers
That ends A Hedge Backwards, a discovery for radio by Henry Reed. The production was by Douglas Cleverdon. This was the cast. Herbert Reeve, Hugh Burden, Stephen Schoen, Carlton Hobbs, Connie, Gwen Cheryl, Nancy Schoen, Dorothy Primrose, Owen, Brian and George Schoen, Dennis Quilley, Wilfred Downing and M. Westbury, Hilda Tablet, Mary O'Farrell, Elder Strauss, Marjorie Westbury, Neville Pikelet, Alan McClelland, General Gland, Derek Giler, Amuffy, Vivian Chatterton, Narrative Prose, Frank Duncan. The characters from the play were Daisy Treadle, Vivian Chatterton, Roger, Michael Meacham, Jenny, Janet Richer. The fragments of Musique Concrète Renforcée and the three settings of There Once Was a Garden were realized by Donald Swan. The program was recorded